Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Hans, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Lovely to be here.
I'm thrilled today to bring you on the show, Hans, and we're obviously you're a dynamic figure in the world of blockchain and digital innovation, a career that spans across continents, really, from Europe to Australia, Asia, America, and you've really dove into technologies, digitization, and notably blockchain. But before I talk about or ask a few questions, why don't you give us just an overview of your background and where you are today?
That's an interesting question. I spent a lot of time in consultancy and especially on business technology with the business and the organizational aspects. And better said, how could technology facilitate your business and how can it help boost your business? And I started doing that for AT&T. And there were a lot of people in AT&T. I worked for the AT&T Bell Labs. There were a lot of people with these big losses. And they were really smart. They came up with really snazzy stuff, but no one actually knew what can we do with it. So I was more or less in that group of people who consulted on the business and consulted on the technology and bridged that, making it intangible projects and products. I've later on got into informal investing, which I really enjoyed the startup scene. It was very fast. A lot of new technologies came around and I really enjoyed that. And the past few years I've been focusing, as you said, on the blockchain. And specifically, I focus on adaptation and on the governance aspect. And since I still see we need a lot to learn yet about blockchain and how it can help us and what it can deliver to us, I started a PhD on blockchain governance a few years ago. And that's a long-term project. Obviously, it's not a career choice anymore for me, but it's more like a hobby project. So it keeps me off the street.
Nice. This show really breaks down some of the simpler things of what we do. And I know blockchain and crypto and all these new digital currency words have been thrown around. But can you just, in the simplest of terms, talk about how blockchain is different from traditional banking systems that most of us are used to?
There are a lot of similarities and obviously there is a lot of overlap. If you look at the similarity and the overlap, they are both logistical transactional protocols. The finance industry is more or less putting money from one hand in the other. Blockchain transacts data, transacts money, transacts whatever you want. So it's a transaction protocol. But the core difference is that in blockchain, it goes peer to peer. There is no need for an intermediary. So it is decentralized in that sense. Peer to peer transactions happen between you and I. It further relies very much on what's called self-sovereign identity. That means I can actually be in charge of transaction. And it also quite often works with zero knowledge proof. And I'm sure we'll get to cover that later on in the show. But the big difference is that it's decentralized. It works on blockchain. It's faster. It's cheaper. And it actually works at the blink of an eye cross-continent. And it's permissionless. You don't need permission. The bank actually needs to authorize your transaction and not just your bank, the intermediate bank, the recipient bank, the sending bank. So sometimes it's 7, 8, 9 permissions. Blockchain is actually permissionless. It's just you and the recipient who engage in the transaction. So in that sense, you become your own bank. And I think especially that slogan, be your own bank, is very much applicable to what the big difference is between blockchain and traditional finance.
Can I ask, why should we care as people who aren't necessarily involved in it? I feel when a new technology comes out, there's that graph, right, where everybody gets really excited about it and then it disappoints and then it slowly creeps into our everyday lives without us really noticing it. This was huge 5 years ago, maybe, and everybody was going nuts about blockchain and saying it was going to transform the world. And then predictably, it fell off the map. People stopped talking about it. How is it going to affect our lives? Why should we care? How is it going to be integrated into everyday life?
Yeah, I definitely agree with what's called the hype cycle. And blockchain is more or less as any other technology suffers that. I agree with you a couple of years ago. blockchain was the big thing. Then it became the metaverse, then it became Web3, now it's AI, now it's machine learning. So we tend to move on to new technologies, but it doesn't mean if a new technology is in the hype that the older technology is fading out. On the contrary, there are a couple of phases that are really important when it comes to the development of a new technology. And I think getting recognition from business is an important component. Getting the recognition from the finance industry is actually money pouring into the technology and other actually use cases. And I think on those three fronts, blockchain is gaining a lot of traction at the moment. So there is money pouring in, institutional money into the blockchain. The ETF, for instance, facilitate that. The businesses are looking into the blockchain itself, banking, healthcare, education, even law, for instance. And also we see more and more use cases and adaptability. And there's also a bridging coming between crypto and traditional finance. So you can actually use your crypto to buy day-to-day products, either for a debit card or spend on, let's say, Travala if you want to go on holiday. So for me, it's definitely, yes, the initial hype is over, but that in the background actually is the whole evolution.
I have also heard the benefits of energy efficiency. Is that true as well on proof of stake? Is that right?
Absolutely. Proof of stake is definitely less energy consumptive. So that's a big thing. And you always get one of the times you get these graphs of how many electricity is used for Bitcoin mining alone. And it sometimes is the same as a whole country. And there's an extraordinary amount. But there's actually a really interesting other side of that coin. And that is because of the extremely growing need and demand of energy, and especially cheap energy, a lot of sustainable energy and alternative energy forms have been developed. So yes, it is extremely aggressive in consumption of energy, but also because of blockchain, we've actually gave a boost to developing more energy friendly and consumer friendly type of energy. Think solar, think water, think wind energy. So actually, the funny side is that because of that, we actually have a lot of cheaper energy as well. So yes, it consumes a lot, but there's also a big benefit.
All right. So I'm a pilot, and I don't proof of stake, proof of these different ways of doing blockchain technology. People are probably like, what the heck am I listening to? What is going on? So maybe some homework to do. But let's make this practical to a pilot who's sitting there thinking, okay, blockchain, why do I care? Right? Maybe my real estate transaction will happen through the blockchain in the future, and it'll be different than going to a title company. But at the end of the day, okay. So a title company doesn't do it. This blockchain technology does it, and it's more efficient. Let's talk about making passive income through blockchain technology. My understanding is that proof of stake is a way to actually potentially make passive income. This is a participatory activity that could generate income. How does a layman get involved in that if they can?
Actually, the good news is, yes, you can, and it's relatively easy. And I think it's one of the great things of proof of stake is that it is actually very low key, low entry. You have your own coins, which you hold in your wallet, and you allocate them towards stake program. That means you still own the coins. You still have the keys of the wallet. So you still have control of the coins, but they're merely locked. And I think of it in a way, in a simple term, as a certificate of deposit, right? So you get an interest, you get a certain yield on that, and you cannot actually access the money straight away for a couple of weeks, couple of months, couple of years. Staking is more or less the same. You have tokens, you're not using them, you have coins, and you allocating them to a staking program, and they give you interest or a return on your investment. And the amount you get for a CD, that usually starts with $1,000. That's a bit of a hurdle already. Staking, you can actually, on Bivix, for instance, you can do that with 10, with 100, with 500 coins already. So that's really low P, and it gives you a good return of 8% per annum. And that's nothing to sneeze at, just from sitting in your chair, do absolutely nothing, and you literally send your money to work. So in layman terms, it's really simple, easy to make.
Can you explain what is happening there, right? Because you're lending coins in order to put up collateral, I understand. in order to verify transactions on the network, right? So you, so what's happening in the background in order to generate those returns?
You're not lending the coins. They stay in your wallet. And that's, I thank you for pointing it out, because there's really a big difference. You do not give away your coins like you do in a certificate of deposit, that a bank actually uses your money and lends it to someone else to make a bit more interest. Then they give you a little bit of that, but they hold most of the money. With staking, the coins stay in your wallet. They're locked in your wallet. In a way, you can see it as a way that facilitates the blockchain and facilitates the transactions. That's where staking and masternodes are useful. So they facilitate the transaction process, and on that you get a fee. So rather than interest, it is a fee that you get on the block reward. That is being split with the masternode holders and with the stakers.
And this would be different than, I know when you're mining Bitcoin, right? That computer has to be on, and it's obviously, it's a big, expensive computer that has a bunch of fans, and it has to be connected all the time.
Precisely.
So is it the same thing with proof of stake, where your computer has to be sitting there turned on the internet?
No, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Tate, because no, it isn't. You don't need to be online. And actually, staking can be really simple. A lot of it, you can do it via your phone, even lock it via your wallet. So you don't need to be online. You don't need to, it's a one-off thing you need to do. That's it. And the money comes in. It's more or less as simple as that. There's actually quite an easy guideline. If you go to pivage.org, for instance, and you go to the tab staking, it really guides you through the process, how it's being done and what you're staking rewards are. So let's say you have 100 tokens, 100 coins. It gives you precisely, it tells you precisely what are you staking rewards. So it's just an easy tool, and it also can guide you through the process. And really, you do not need to be a technical nerd in order to be able to stake. I can do it.
I feel like this is the natural evolution here. And that income is coming from the transactions, right? Because there's a small cost to every transaction that occurs.
Correct. Yeah, it's the block reward, and the block reward is where all the transactions and in the Pivot blockchain are being calculated on, and your coins are being generated, and that is being split between the masternode holders and the stakers. So it's an automatic process being handled by the transactions that occur in the Pivot blockchain.
So interesting.
What's the market look like for this? Is this like something that not a lot of people know about, and then in 10 years it's going to be even more popular? What's the runway look like?
I think it will take a while before it really becomes more interesting and more mainstream, because there is a lot of staking in the DeFi sphere, and that's something completely different. Staking in DeFi is that you actually often sign over your tokens or your coins, and they are at risk. So staking within the blockchain of a specific coin, in this case, PIVX, you and need to keep ownership. So staking within DeFi, decentralized finance, has a lot of popularity and is definitely becoming more popular, but also has a lot of risks. And that is definitely something we do not have in our team. We do not have those high rewards, but also high risk. It's a passive income, as you say.
And where would someone go to learn about this, other than getting their appetite interested on the show here? Where did you get your background, and where would someone understand how to dive deeper into this topic?
Yeah, I think your question actually is broader than just that specifically, because I think the really beauty of that, the good thing of that question is that it touches on something the community as a whole struggles with. We're all relatively new. Blockchain is new. We're all relatively new. We're all learning every day. And the technology moves relatively fast. The technology, I do not necessarily find intuitive. So we all need to learn. If I just look at PIVX, for instance, on our website, there are a couple of tools you can use. You can go to Discord, you can go to Telegram, you can go to our forum and simply ask questions. Hey guys, I've learned about staking. I'm really interested. How does it work? Okay, help me. And on PIVX.org, our website, there are tutorials to help you through and to guide you through the process. And if you're still not quite sure, there's actually helplines. You can actually help, reach out, and people can help you get things in order. But I think overall, your question was, and that's more important, that we also knew in this industry that we need to make sure that we not all have science degrees. We do not all have a computer background. So we still need to learn. And it also gives us, as a blockchain, the owners of responsibility that we actually guide and help and educate our community. And that's why we are so keen on podcasts or AMAs, because it gives us a perfect opportunity to actually to talk about things and to guide people through the process and to make them less nervous in entering this.
It's a lot like Scott Galloway was talking about how Coinbase is the AOL of the crypto space, right? Like when the internet first came out, nobody knew how to get online. It was like, there's this thing, but I don't know how to access it. And AOL was the first one that sent you a CD in a cereal box. And it was like, okay, they're making this easy. And now the internet is just ubiquitous. Before we dive into, I don't know, a little bit more what's coming in the future and how it's going to roll into everyday life, can you explain how PIVX fits into the whole ecosystem? I think most people know that there's Bitcoin, they know that there's Ethereum, and then there's thousands of other coins with varying degrees of volatility, varying use cases. So what is PIVX? We spoke about it a little bit in the intro, but can you tell us, how did you arrive here? What was PIVX specifically created for, and where does it fit into the whole contextual ecosystem?
Okay. About the questions, and I'll try to remember them, to answer them everything. And if I forget something, please remind me. I think, first of all, you're absolutely right, because we know Bitcoin, we know Ethereum, and if you really push hard, I think I've heard of Cardano, this Litecoin, but that's it. This exhausts the knowledge of the most people now. And for instance, even the term token and coin are used interchangeable by most people. And a coin is a cryptocurrency on its own blockchain. A token is a cryptocurrency on another blockchain, either Solana or the Ethereum. And there are thousands, literally thousands of tokens, I think tens of thousands of tokens, but there are only a few coins. PIVX has its own blockchain and is therefore a coin. And we use the term altcoin for that because it's an alternative to the mother of all coins, to Bitcoin. PIVX is also one of the older ones, so it's already 8 years in existence, which makes it almost a dinosaur in the ecosystem. And the specific focus of PIVX was on privacy. And a lot of people in the beginning always thought, and still a lot of people say, that cryptocurrency is private and it gives you anonymity. No, it does not. It gives you pseudonymity at best. But privacy isn't becoming a more and more important aspect. And the philosophy with it is that privacy is a fundamental basic human right. And you should also be able to transact peer-to-peer just between you and just in the other side of that transaction. And no one else should be included or involved or have to be aware of that transaction. So PIVX gives the opportunity to shield your transaction. A lot of people actually use PIVX as any other currency like Bitcoin and Ethereum, so you can follow the transactions completely, but you can actually shield as a recipient or as sender your transaction, so you can shield part of the transaction if you choose to do so. And that is precisely what self-sovereign identity is, because it helps you give you control over what you want to share and how you want to participate in the transaction. So for PIVX, the role of privacy has from its inception been the core of its of what it is and what you're all about, privacy.
It feels like at least here in the U.S., with anti-money laundering laws coming out, the new requirement to register LLCs, the reduction in the amount to $600 in, say, if you have more than $600 in a Venmo transactions per year, then the IRS wants to know about it. So are you getting pushback from government institutions which are moving the other direction, that are moving towards, they want more data, more transparency on transactions?
Each country has its own set of rules and regulations, so I can't answer the question in a global context. so there's correlation possible. However, it's true to say there are different countries who have different interpretations and handling cryptocurrencies. I always need to laugh a little if I hear people talk about wire money laundering and prevent funding from terrorism. Yeah, that's usually the arguments governments use in order to get more control. But is it actually specifically used for money laundering or financing terrorism? And if you look at almost any bank in the world, a major bank, they launder $1 billion per day, and that's just before the coffee break. So a lot of the banks and the financial institution handle a lot of dirty money, do that knowingly, get a slap on the wrist, get a fine, and it's business as usual. I'm not dismissing the fact that there are people who might want to stay under the radar and want to use cryptocurrencies for that. But if you just look at the total market capitalization of cryptocurrency, it is still actually quite small. So the problem in that sense doesn't make it as big. Secondly, most of the transactions still go via centralized exchanges. And those centralized exchanges, at one point in time, disclose their holdings and your information to the government or to the tax authority. So there is a catch there already built in by governments that by letting centralized exchanges opening their books to them, they more or less have a good understanding of what's going on. And if you look at Europe, for instance, it's one of the bigger jurisdictions globally. The European Union is like 600 million consumers. They recently adopted and introduced MiCA, that is the new regulations for marketing crypto assets regulations act. And they actually now regulate and give opportunity to service providers in crypto to regulate and to actually deal and handle in cryptocurrencies. And the consumer itself is not included in that. It only wants protection for the consumer. And centralized exchanges at the end always have their books open to authorities if need be. Yes, it could be an issue. I don't think we know exactly how big the issue is, but we also know that money laundering is rife in anything. And I assume it's probably part of crypto as well.
Speaking of education, I wanted to expand this, our vocabulary today for our listeners who might not know anything about this, which is typically me. I want to talk about zero knowledge proofs. Can you explain the concept of the zero knowledge proofs? And I understand this is basically a method that allows one party to prove to another that a given statement is true without conveying any part of the information. And if you wouldn't mind.
No, of course not. No, it is as you said. And I actually can do a little test, if you like, that makes it a little easier perhaps to understand. I got two pens here. One is green, one is red. Right? Correct?
Correct. I see that on the screen. For those on the YouTube panel, you can see it.
Okay, you need to be attractive here. So let's say for argument, say that I'm colorblind and I cannot see the difference between those two pens. So I'm putting them behind my back and I'm holding up one. And you need to tell me what color is this?
We see that it's green. And that's green again. And now it's red.
Okay. So what happened is that behind the back, I was actually switching the pen from one hand in the other. You could not see I was switching the pen from one hand in the other. So I knew that first time you said, this is a red pen, that is a green pen. With that knowledge, I actually switched the pen and tested whether you would come up with the same answer every time for the color of the pen that I held up. So if I do that once and you get the correct answer, I say, okay, that's a lucky guess. You do it twice on same game, like it goes. You do it three times, four times, five times, six times, the same result. Then you think, okay, this is too lucky to guess all the time. So if you do that 10 times, the probability of you guessing that 10 times correct is 0.009%. So the probability actually goes to almost 100%. So that's an example of how zero knowledge proof in a practical setting works. So what it does is that me as a prover and you as a verifier come to an understanding that we both understand that this is the red and this is the green, but I'm colorblind and I cannot see the difference. But because of you giving me those answers, I know that this is red and this is green. Now, one of the things you can actually use it for, and it has been used for, is remember COVID. It's almost a distant memory already for a lot of people. But during COVID, you could not necessarily get access to a restaurant, to a school, or to a function without a QR code. And that QR code gave you access to the bill or to the function or to the restaurant. But it didn't say whether you actually were fully vaccinated. It didn't say whether you actually had a test done, A, you were negative, or it didn't say that you were recovered correctly from COVID. It was either of these three. It just said, he's fine, he can access the bill. So that's an example where zero knowledge proof worked. The person who actually looked at the QR code said, yeah, he's good to go, he can come into the building, but he didn't know I was vaccinated. Vaccinated is something that is a personal choice that might upset people, might not upset people. It's no one's business but mine. So there's an example of how the zero knowledge proof works. So it allows you to prove facts, let's say my identity, without giving the underlying information. Same goes if you want to go to a restaurant or to a bar, you need to show your ID. So why do you need to show your ID? There's your birth date on it. There's all sort of information on it. It only needs to me that you are 18 or older. That's the only thing that's relevant. But yet you need to show all that information. So that could be another application where zero knowledge proof can be used. So it gives you, as a holder of that information, that specific information, it gives you the possibility to demonstrate that the fact is indeed true, but you still keep the fact hidden. That's in a nutshell what zero knowledge proof.
Interesting. And how is this different than privacy when you look at blockchain versus Bitcoin? What would be, which is more of a fully public tokenization, what would you say that what the difference is there?
Then a couple of things being used generally in Bitcoin. And I think in blockchain, we use three things come together. There's decentralization, that's self-sovereign identity, and that's zero knowledge proof. All come together in blockchain and also within Bitcoin. But all three of those phenomena, decentralization, zero knowledge proof, and self-sovereign identity, are not new. They're not new phenomena. It's just that they come to a different set of light within blockchain. If you look at, for instance, what would be the difference between, let's say, a credit card company and a blockchain that uses a zero knowledge proof, the credit card company, for instance, has access to all that information. Even if I do a retail transaction, the credit card company still has access to all sorts of information of me. So they are a centralized entity. They're not peer-to-peer. They actually review the actual information. I only need to prove on the blockchain that that information is actually true. And I think the biggest difference is that the old school is based on trust and blockchain is based on trustless. So you actually don't trust, but you verify. And you certify that via zero knowledge proof way. I do understand, and that gives you then ultimately the privacy we also desperately crave for. And I do understand that it still sounds a bit lofty, but I think that the core difference is that I am in charge of information about myself, and I choose when and how to share that on a need-to-know basis with another party. And a credit card company can do that at random without you knowing. And I think that's what the big difference is between self-sovereign identity and zero knowledge proof within the blockchain setup.
Can I shift gears into how to spend cryptocurrency, right? Because there's always the issue of you have to convert US dollars or euros or whatever fiat currency you have into a cryptocurrency, which can be very volatile in price. Yep. And then you have to convert it back into a fiat currency in order to spend it. And to be fair, the argument is always it's volatile because whatever crypto you're talking about is only worth what it's worth because people agree that's what it's worth. And to be fair, that's exactly the way fiat currency works today. The entire world has come off the gold standard. The US dollar is only worth what it's worth because we all agree that's what it's worth. The euro is only worth what it's worth because we all agree, because there's really nothing backing it up anymore after we came off the gold standards. But with that being said, a vast majority of the globe agrees that the US dollar is worth X. And so how do you get around this issue of converting dollars or euros into cryptocurrency, and then you're getting past the volatility and then getting past the fact that you have to eventually convert it back. Can you speak to that?
Well, what you're talking about is what's called the fiat ramp, and that's getting from your day-to-day dollars into the cryptocurrencies and vice versa. That's called the fiat ramp. And most of the ramps are via exchanges because they're regulated, you transfer money, comes to your account, and then with that you can. There are a few ATMs where you can actually deposit cash or transfer cash, and then you get coins, but that's the more a novelty rather than anything else, to be honest. So the ramp is still, I would say, the Achilles heel to the whole system, but that's definitely a bottleneck for sure. And because at the end of the day, cryptocurrencies are nice and they do represent value, can do all sorts of stuff with it, depending on the blockchain. But at one point in time, people want to convert cryptocurrencies either back to dollars or whatnot. So you need to take it off the ramp. So one of the things a lot of people use is debit cards. And there are a few, the Birax or even Binance has them. Most of the exchanges have one sort of credit card, debit card, I should say, in which you can transfer your cryptos directly, and with that you can go retail. So that actually makes the off ramp a lot easier already. There are also companies that accept cryptos, and more do that. Starbucks is piloting with it. Travala, the travel website, they accept cryptocurrencies. So it is not necessarily the traditional off ramp always needed for spending it in the real world or the real economy, if you like. And that's hinges on one simple thing, and that's called adaptation. And the more people use it, the more adaptation there is, the more liquidity there is, and the more trust there is in the underlying system, the more retailers will start accepting it. So that's the chicken and the egg phenomenon. It's an economies of scale. The more people are entering the sphere, the more retailers are willing to accept. And ultimately, that would diminish also the need for a fiat on-ramp fiat exchange.
What do you think about volatility? Because that's the issue that I'm seeing with transferring $10,000 into PIVX and then staking it and earning 8 to 10%. What if the value of PIVX comes down by 50%? Now that 8 to 10% per year is essentially not doing me any good, right? What are your thoughts around volatility?
It reminds me a bit of an episode of South Park. And it's gone, right?
That's right. And I guarantee that there are a lot of pilots listening to this that have played with some current cryptocurrency and it's gone. Yep. Myself included.
I can't really blame them for having that notion about it. And volatility is definitely an issue. Well, even recently, for instance, when Iran launched all those drones and rockets on Israel, the Bitcoin dropped almost 8-9%. And some other cryptocurrency dropped 20-30%. And it's huge. That was really massive. So there is definitely a lot of volatility, nervousness, and unpredictability in the market. And that also comes because there's still a lack of liquidity. And if you look at the total market cap of cryptos, it's $2.5 trillion. A lot of money. It really is a lot of money. But if you actually look at the total liquidity globally, that's $1.5 quadrillion, and it's 1.5 and then 15 zeros. So that's a lot. That's really a lot. And then the market cap of crypto actually is minute. That's a drop in the ocean on the whole liquidity. So liquidity is still an issue. That's one. Secondly, there is a big level of anxiety. People are, on one hand, fearing to miss out, but they're also fearing to lose their money. And once people start selling, the next one sells, and you get next thing, you end up with a fire sale, and your currency drops 20 or 30%. So liquidity and adaptation and the user base are definitely still left to be desired, I would say, in order to come to a more stable thing. So even Bitcoin, during the example I mentioned with Iran, drone attack on Israel, even that was the Bitcoin not immune for. So that goes to show there's still a lot of nervousness in the market, and we still need to mature the market because, in honestly, and that's one of the things that really bothers me and upsets me and actually annoys me, a lot of people go into the crypto and think, I can make 100% return on investment within a matter of days. As long as we still think that's normal, and a lot of people still find that acceptable and actually think that it's going to happen, then you will keep that nervousness and volatility in the market. So when it comes to, have I lost my money if I'm staking? Do your own research. Never invest more than you can afford to lose. If you stick to those two guidelines, you're good.
That's great.
Well, Hans, we really appreciate you coming on. I want to transition into one more kind of section of this, which you've really talked about specifically some of the securitization and proof of stake, specifically with in terms of privacy. But I wanted to explore like the economic and governance models with some of these projects, ties to back to the larger theme of decentralizing and democratizing the capital and use of money. And I wanted to talk about the introduction of the DAO, which is the Decentralized Autonomous Organization, which is funny because it seems like it's a structure with no centralized leadership, run by rules, encoded by a computer that is transparent, but then it's controlled by its members and been independent of central state influence. So, wow, like that's completely different than what we have currently in our monetary system. So can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. At Pivx, we have a big campfire and we sit around it and we sing Kumbaya all day. That's sometimes what people think when you hear the DAO, or a lot of people think of the 60s, the hippies and the provost. They also had this vision that there shouldn't be a central authority and we all should live in a commune and we should live all happily ever after. And that's not necessarily what the DAO does. The DAO is an organizational concept that recognizes that the technology can more or less take care of itself, but there are always unforeseen circumstances that can happen that needs intervention. And so how do you go about that intervention? And that's more or less the core of what governance is in the blockchain. How do you make sure that you can make a strategic change? How can you make sure that you do an update to the protocol? When do you do it? How do you do it? And why do you? This, the governance aspect, and that's quite often decided by the DAO, the Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And the core of it is that there's no manager. We're all equal. And that makes it actually quite interesting, but it also means that everyone who raises his or her hand is all of a sudden a stakeholder and can be part of the DAO and can partly discussing and debate about it. Now, how you come to that decision is a different thing. And quite often there's some sort of voting mechanism that can either be related to the holding of the tokens of the coins you have. It can be related to mining activity you do, or it can be related to your presence simply in the DAO. But it is quite often like a voting and a consensus mechanism in that arrives at the decision. Yes, it sounds quite lofty, but you need to understand that quite often the blockchain itself takes care of itself. That's once it starts, it keeps going. It doesn't need intervention. And that's precisely what we wanted it to do, because we don't trust people to get involved. That's why we have the blockchain. But sometimes for unforeseen circumstances, updates, you need to intervene or you need to do something. How you arrive at a change, that is the governance aspect, and that can be done by the DAO. And the DAO is, in that sense, an ideal vehicle, but also a very incomprehensible vehicle. If you look at the blockchain, for instance, no one is in charge of the Bitcoin. No one owns the Bitcoin. No one is in charge of the Bitcoin. Yet it's the longest running blockchain we have. It has a value of more than $60,000. People are happy to invest in it and buy and trade and exchange it. There must be something in that structure that actually works. And that is quite an interesting thing of the DAO. But there is one thing in the DAO that is actually also a bit of the Achilles heel. And I think Plato already pointed it out once that democracy is really nice, but it's determined by the people who actually show up and to vote. And that also goes for the DAO. And apathy in the community can be definitely an issue that people are not involved, couldn't care, or forgot, or have other priorities. And then a minority can actually make a better opposition for the DAO. So there is a lot to be said for it. And I really like the concept of community-driven governance, what the DAO basically is. But you always need to be aware that there are also downsides. And pitfalls, if you like.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Hans, I really appreciate your time. I always ask one question at the end when I remember. What's something that you've learned in the last 6 months about blockchain, crypto, that you haven't shared with other people, or maybe you have, I don't know, that has really changed the way you think about this technology and this evolution?
I think what I've learned is that the power of community is actually a lot stronger than I thought it would be. Yes, I believe in the underlying technology, but the power of community is actually extremely strong, and it really fit in the situation we are in today. We live in a society that is almost an example of a lack of trust. There is no trust in politicians, not in the legal system. We don't trust the police. We don't trust the accountants. We don't trust our neighbors. A lack of trust is a big issue. Now, what if we can use technology to help reestablish the trust in society, that we can actually have a society where we can actually work towards trusting each other again? And if technology can play a role in that, then I would be all for in introducing blockchain in that sense into society. So what have I learned? I do believe that it's definitely a right time and the right place for blockchain to look at societal challenges we are facing.
If someone's interested, if someone's listening to this and they think they're catching the bug and they want to learn more about this stuff, how did you get your background? Are there books that you would recommend? Are there, I know you mentioned your website, which we'll absolutely link to in the show notes, that has some information there. But if somebody wants to really go deeper, do you have any references?
Speak about books. This is definitely a book I recommend from Kevin Venbos. He's professor at the Barton-Wharton Institute. And he talks about blockchain as a new architecture of trust. And he explains why we actually came towards blockchain, what it really is, how it happened, what are the fundamental challenges we came to address and try to overcome. So that's, if you want to learn a bit about it, this is really, really a good book. Secondly, I can only say there's sort of a mantra you need to live by, and that is read, learn, talk, ask, read some more, read again, ask again, talk again. Go to forums, go to chat rooms, go to Discords, and just simply ask people. And there are a lot of idiots in that sphere, trust me, but also a lot of people who are really nice, really educated and polite, and can help you navigate through those challenges. And our blockchain, Pivix, has a nice forum. If you go to our website, pivix.org, other projects have more or less the same. So I could only encourage you to read and to ask and to talk to people and just debate, learn. That's how you slowly become more comfortable. And also make sure that you always live by the mantra of do your own research. Don't invest more than you can afford to lose, not your keys, not your coins. And the network is secure, the blockchain is secure, but your computer might not be. So also make sure that your computer is actually secure.
Such good advice.
Amazing. Hans, I took away a lot. Thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Hans. We appreciate your expertise.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next show.